Brigadier Calvert, Reel 4.
I was just saying that I was sent home after writing my report. There may be bits of my report which I want to come back later. I rather hurried over it. But I'll get on with what I'm saying. I was interrogated at the War Office. I say interrogated, asked questions, better way, by all sorts of people about supplies and about equipment and about clothing and about, this is for the whole country, and operations and by intelligence and so on. And amongst other things, I was, there's now a Conservative government in, and I had to see Lord Chandos, he wasn't Lord Chandos at the time, he got a double barrel name, I forget. And he asked me, I think somebody had briefed me, I don't think somebody had planted this name into my brain, but he asked me, after having said this, that, and the other, I said, I realized I'm going to see him for an hour. And so I said, I have 12 points, and if you don't agree with my first point, all the rest are useless. So he said, come on, give it to us. And I said, there must be one plan and one man and with the powers to carry it out. I think I said one man with one plan and with the powers to carry it out. And he said, right, what are the other points? And so I gave the various points that there should be. A lot of them I'd got from other people about the separation of the people from the jungle I can't go into them all now, but one was that there should be a special counterinsurgency force. I gave the analogy of the quinine and the malarial germ, which should stay all the time on the trail of the guerrillas and be... then I finished up with my 12th point, and I said, all these are useless unless there's one man with one plan and the powers to carry it out. And so he said, right, who do you suggest? My first suggestion was Casey. If you remember, he later became Lord Casey, Governor General of Australia. He had been Governor of Bengal. First of all, he'd been Churchill's representative in the Middle East, and he then made Governor of Bengal during the frightful times of the insurgencies when hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And he was a great man. And I also thought that he was an Australian and he would have connections with Australia there. And very often Australians can say things which British people can't say. But Lord Chandos said, no, supposing he's a British service officer, we can't have Casey. And I said, the man, if I was a guerrilla, the man I'd be most frightened of to have against me, because he's very efficient, he can be quite ruthless, and he's got charm, is General Templer. And Chandos noted his name down. Whether he'd been given his name before or not, I don't know. It's really all I've got to report about that. I can't really give the details of my report. I could if I'd worked on it, but I don't think of anything.
What had put Templer's name into your mind?
Well, I'd met him, and I had a great... I'd met him at these Chief of the Imperial General Staff meetings, you know, Montgomery meetings. And I'd been very impressed amongst all this wonderful lot of officers, general officers, by his penetrating capacity to sort of needle into your mind. And he appeared to be ruthless in asking questions and so on of that nature. And he struck me as a highly intelligent man. And I also think that somebody had planted his name into my mind. I don't know. But anyway, he came there and he was made Chief of Imperial General Staff, as Harding was. And I was just a person on the way. Well, then I went back, and my job was to raise the SAS. So before this, I think it was before this, Harding said the Rhodesians want to send somebody, they wanted to go to send a unit to Korea. Well, we reckoned they could be of more use in Malaya, and I want you to go over to Rhodesia and talk to them and raise a unit. By this time, I was under command of Urquhart. Now, I don't want to be... I must be a bit rude about Urquhart, if I can tell the truth. He's a very brave man, very fine officer, but not very intelligent. And he didn't have much idea of geography. Anyway, I was sent this enormous distance from Singapore to Rhodesia. And there were no proper airlines. I was hurried off. I was given an air ticket and not the proper visas en route. I got my yellow yellow fever inoculation at the university, because there was no medical officers had yellow fever inoculation. I got on an aircraft to Cairo, and the idea was I just sort of thumbed my lift all the way through. From Cairo, I went to Kenya, where they grabbed me, and I gave two talks on guerrilla warfare in Kenya. It was just the beginnings of the Mau Mau revolt. And then I went to Rhodesia. I was received very well in Rhodesia by the governor, oh God, I'm forgetting his name, Dr. somebody or other, and they sent me on holiday to Victoria Falls, and then I went round I went to Victoria Falls and stayed there, interviewed people, and then went to Bulawayo, and because of the bad weather, I took a train to Salisbury again. There I saw the governor and the commander-in-chief, and I was taken out to where they were forming the Rhodesian SAS. I gave a talk to them, and the commander was a young officer whom I should remember his name. I have to give it to you later. He later became commander-in-chief in Rhodesia during the Rhodesian War. I was introduced to everybody and saw them all. And later they came out to Malaya under my command. I then took an aircraft back, even more difficulty catching aircraft across Africa, no through. I had a ticket, but no through booking. And I eventually finished up in Thailand, with only Rhodesian money, and I had to get it changed. I couldn't get it changed anywhere. And finally I got down to Malaya. Now, I'd been away, I think, about a fortnight. And General Urquhart gave me a hell of a rock. He said, why had I been away? Why had I taken so long? I'd taken all that distance. I'd given lectures in various places, done this, that, and the other, raised a force, and come back again. I think I did 22,000 miles in 12 days, I think I remember. And then he said, why had I taken so long? I always remember that. He had no idea of the distances. I ought to say that there were a lot of people gunning for me. They did not like the idea of another special force. A lot of people, they knew I was close to Wingate, and they didn't like that. The Gurkhas, whom I liked very much indeed, they said that only the Gurkhas were any good in the jungle, and what did I want to raise a special force for? I had a lot of opposition, and it was only General Harding, and also the usual medical opposition. Fortunately, the...
What do you mean by the usual medical opposition?
Well, I'll come back to that. Unfortunately, the DDMS, Director of Medical Services in Singapore, I got on very well with him. He'd been in West Africa, and he believed in the medical method of winning over tribes to your side. It's rather like boys on paper. There is a method when was used very much in India. When a general, a subordinate general, did not want to carry out his commander's orders, he would bring in the medical personnel to say a thing was impossible, or the unit was unfit, or that the commander hadn't looked after his unit, and so on. And they used this medical card. I don't know whether it's used in other armies, but it was used in the Indian Army. Now, Urquhart's chief of staff was Indian Army. He'd done very well, I think, in the Arakan, I learned later. But he was very touchy. He did not like the idea of another special force. And I had difficulty with him. So anyway, I started to recruit, but they put in special stipulations, possibly I should have held out against. They said that I could ask for volunteer officers, I can inspect them, but the men must be detailed by battalions. Result was, I got some very good officers. I went over to Hong Kong, I went around and this, that and the other, and got some good officers. But the men, they sort of sent their boxing team. I heard there was a tough job on. It was put in the wrong way. Now, you want intelligence people. Intelligent people. But I decided that I would follow General Wingate's precepts, is that he said any man can command good troops, but it takes a real commander to train good troops, bad troops, or indifferent troops, into good soldiers. And so I accepted these men, and a lot of them, most of them, turned out very, very good. But if you read the books on the SAS, they start off, their first chapter is a bad beginning about my starting the 22nd SAS. Well, it was difficult. I had stipulated that I should have a decent quartermaster, a decent adjutant, which is essential when you're forming a unit. And they didn't post anybody to me, and they sort of said, you don't need one until you've got 100 men. But of course, you need a quartermaster and an adjutant at the beginning of forming a regiment, much more than you do once it's been formed. This caused me a lot of trouble, because there was I attending high-level conferences, going out on reconnaissances, going down to Singapore, and also being commanding officer, doing the planning and training and administration, like sort of the loss of a compass or something, and the whole thing together. I've never been so busy in my life, and I've never had such a strain on myself as that. At the same time, you're allowed to be shot. Just going from my camp south of Kuala Lumpur, backwards and forwards. I'd been ambushed twice during my original 6 months reconnaissance. On one occasion, my driver and I went to go unarmed, but in uniform, and one time there's a hail of bullets at us, and my driver drove into a ditch, and we jumped out and lay in the ditch, and there was a hail of fire overhead, and eventually a grenade landed by us, and we just covered our heads, hoping we wouldn't be injured, and the grenade didn't go off, and the firing ceased, and then I found there was a label attached to the grenade, the pin was still in, and said, how do you do, Mr. Calvert? Either to somebody I'd taught previously, or they were using psychological warfare on me, I don't know. But
this was in English?
Yes. But we worked closely with Special Branch and the police. And there were a lot of rivalries between the police and the army. There always are in a insurgency problem. And there were these British battalions still trying to be reformed with, in a number of cases, very, I'd say, inefficient commanding officers. I give another example. This is during my reconnaissance. I went out with the Scots Guards, and they couldn't have tried harder. There was an excellent commanding officer, company commander. I usually found the company commanders were good, but they were rather rigid. They were told to go to a place, so they took a compass bearing and went absolutely straight across to that place, or tried to. They hacked a way through, and they hacked and hacked and hacked the jungle. They didn't use the riverbeds and the ridges, etc., to find the way through. They made a hell of a lot of noise. They were strong men, six-footers. And eventually we got to this place. And I suggested that they should patrol in small parties. Because I said, and it's a teaching of mine, that the smaller the number in a patrol, the more frightened you are. Therefore, the more cautious you are, therefore, the more silent you are, and therefore, the more likely you are to meet the enemy. And so I had recommended that patrols, having formed a patrol base, you should patrol out in fours. Now, this is, or something like that. Now, this doesn't fit into the organization of a battalion. I will say the guards themselves and the men couldn't have been more determined to do well. But when I saw the CO, and I had to see the CO after all the patrols I used to go out naturally, and I suggested this to him in a quiet way, he said, "Look, my battalion shouldn't be here." He said, "We were raised and trained and organized to fight in Europe. I'm not going to upset the whole organization and training of my battalion just to chase a lot of bare-ass niggers around in the jungle." Yes, and when I was I used to see General Harding, I suppose about once a fortnight, once a 3 weeks, or probably longer between. And I said to him, I said, "It's hopeless, things hopeless, that you'd never get people to do it." And he said, "What's the matter?" And I told him that this had happened. And he said, "Give me his name." And I said, "If you remember when I first spoke to you, I said I'd report to you, but I wouldn't give people's names because it would make everybody suspicious of me. And they wouldn't be frank to me." And he said, he was bound to the table, I want his name. And finally he brought in his chief of staff, he put on his helmet, hat, and said, "Colonel Calvert, I order you to give me the name of this officer." So I stood up and I gave him the name of the officer. Then he dictated to his chief of staff, said, "I want that officer brought down tomorrow with a packed suitcase." And the colonel of the Scots Guards was brought down, and he was put on a plane and sent straight back to London. This was Harding trying to find a way to enthuse his battalions, his men under his command, to operate and realize this was his job to do. There was an air of lethargy and weariness. I say a lot of it, I think, may have been due to these ex-prisoners of war colonels. General Urquhart was a very gallant paratroop commander, but he didn't seem to have the capacity to enthuse people on this, whatever I say, it's the climate and everything else. The civilian staff, an awful lot of them had been prisoners of war with the Japanese, and a lot of them seemed to have lost the will to rule. There's also a lot who was the Chinese who'd helped us, and the Chinese in their revolt had got a very good case. The pro-Malayan faction had produced a constitution. We were trying to hand over Malaya, which gave all power to the Malay sultans and treated the 2 million Chinese, who were 50% of the population, as non-persons. They got no vote, and yet they were the people who had supported us during the war and who'd fought the Japanese, whereas the Malays had given in to the Japanese straight away, apart from negligible few. So when people say that guerrilla warfare doesn't succeed, it does succeed up to a point. In this particular case, after 14 years of fighting, the Chinese got the vote and have got quite a big say in the constitution, but now that is receding again. But they had that. The police were, apart again from some exceptions, including the special branch, they would tend to be pro-Malay. Special branch, because they had to get the information, had some very, very good Chinese under their command. I was pulled one way or another by these different factions to try and impress on me, and they knew I had the ear of the top people, and giving their views. It was a very, very hard time. And then I had to form this new unit. Well, I think I ought to start. I was saying about, I now had to form this new unit. I wanted to call it something like the South Pacific Rangers, but it was decided to call it the Malayan Scout. This was the inference of the Chief of Staff, who had been in the Indian Army. One of the problems was in 1952 that the guerrillas, the Chinese, mostly Chinese guerrillas, were gaining ascendancy, and the British High Command was rather lashing about, trying to find a solution, and the British units hadn't got into the way of doing things in the jungle. The Gurkhas had had a reorganization, and the Malay regiment was, I really say at that time, very bad. They had tried Sparrow Force, a small force organized by Sir Robert Thompson and others who had been in the Malay civil service and people who had operated in Malaya during the war and who had known all the main participants of the revolt, because it was a revolt. But they were suspect, because they knew the Ne Win and all the head top people. And
Ne Win?
Not Ne Win.
Chin Peng.
Chin Peng and the top people. In fact, Chin Peng had been to Britain, taken part in the victory parade, and had been decorated with the OBE, I think. And they all had a very high respect for him. So they became rather suspect from the police. Now, the police were predominantly Malay, although their best detectives were mostly Chinese. They'd brought in a chief of police from Palestine, and there were a lot of ex-Palestine policemen there, some very good indeed. But the chief of police, I don't remember his name, he, let's put it this way, he had a very fine figure of a man and very good presence and so on like that, but he had some